This is News and Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, the latest on the NAACP and a man sues for the right to be drunk. From our New York bureau, Bob Meadows, a writer with People magazine, and E.R. Shipp, a columnist at the New York Daily News. Also with us, Glenn Lowry, professor of economics at Boston University. He joins us from member station WBUR in Boston. All right, folks, let's get right into the NAACP. They are meeting this week in Milwaukee to talk about a number of things. But most interestingly, Julian Bond is once again railing against the president. He suggests that the president likes the talk or likes to talk the talk, but doesn't like to walk the walk. That's what he told members at the annual convention this week. He also chided the president, saying, "Mr. President, we're extending the invitation a year in advance. We want to see you with us." And he's talking about next year when the NAACP will meet in Washington, D.C. Those of you will remember that Julian Bond attacked the president a few months back, and the IRS was looking into the NAACP's status as a nonprofit. So some will suggest that perhaps Julian Bond did not learn a lesson many believe the White House was trying to teach him. Bob Meadows, what's your thought here?
So many, Ed. You know, I covered the NAACP for years, and I'm really glad to see them back in the news. I'm thinking that the NAACP, they might be in for their most public contentiousness since Ben Chavis, because while you have Julian Bond making these claims, and he seems to give the same speech, as you said, like every few months, every year or so, Bruce Gorin, the new executive director, he wants to reach out. He's actually saying he wants to reach out to the Bush administration, get friendlier ties with them. And I'm wondering, is if people have wondered for years, Bruce Gorin does not come from the typical NAACP background for their leadership. And there's a wonder, will the members of the NAACP actually follow what Bruce Gorin wants to do? The way Julian Bond is speaking, I question it.
You know, I have known Julian Bond for years. When I was a big Afro-haired, University of Georgia, thought of myself as radical girl, I asked him to become my campaign manager when I ran for president of the United States of America. That's a long time ago. But I have to say that I have long thought the NAACP was kind of stuck in the mud. I don't know Bruce Gorin, but it may be a desperation move to have picked someone like him who's so different from all the previous leaders, but it also could be an inspired move. And whether the rank and file follow suit, I don't know, but it may bring in new people. And I think if the NAACP is going to be around and be relevant, it needs to bring in newer people. I'm not a lifelong member of the NAACP. I've never thought I wanted to join the NAACP because they always seemed a little bit too irrelevant to what I thought needed to be acted upon.
Let me ask this, Glenn, and you can pick up here on your thoughts as well. But with the president once again declining the invitation of the NAACP to speak, and before, we should note that the White House and the president suggested, why would you go speak to what he characterized as a hostile group? He believed that the NAACP, at least powers that be in the NAACP were hostile toward him. And of course, after that, he did have a meeting with Kwasi Mfume before he stepped away. But we should also note that the NAACP invited Mexican President Vicente Fox to come down and speak to the group after his controversial comments that we've covered on this program. He too declined two invitations to attend the convention. Does this speak to the power or lack thereof of this group in terms of being a muscle force that people have to deal with?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, how many troops has got the NAACP? I mean, I wish the NAACP well. I think it would be very important for the NAACP and for many black institutions to think seriously about redefining their mission in the, you know, current situation. But the fact is that they're not exactly an important movement or institution within what is now a minority political, you know, a political orientation. The president and his party are wielding power across the board. Why would
you know how they're doing it, though?
NAACP?
They're doing it through going to some of the institutions that are more closely connected to local communities. They're going through churches, for example.
They're going around the black leadership.
They're going around Absolutely. The self-appointed, in many cases, black leadership. Or
but
the
we wouldn't
press
have George
appointed
Bush
black leadership.
I mean, anyone that George Bush talks to is going to be de facto black leadership. Are we going to let George W. Bush decide who are the black people we're talking to and
no,
we're hearing
but we
from
can
in this
show
country?
Up at the meeting.
Well, but isn't it easy? Isn't it easy for us to criticize? And it seems to me that there are a lot of African Americans who criticize groups like the NAACP, the National Urban League, and the like. Yet when individuals get in trouble or groups get in trouble, they do look to these organizations. And quite frankly, many of those who criticize either have not joined these organizations or are doing very little on their own to change the state of black America.
Well, you
that
know,
wouldn't be
it's
true
sort of
me.
Like with the police. You know, police get criticized a lot as well. But, yeah, when somebody robs your house, that's who you call. One of the things, you know, for years, the NAACP has been, critics say it's adrift, you know, it doesn't have a focus or anything. The NAACP made its bones on legal cases, on legal battles, housing discrimination, job discrimination, etc. A way for the NAACP to really get back in the mix is by going back to those roots. We have a lot of legal cases coming up right now. The Supreme Court just lost O'Connor. Rehnquist might be going out. There are a lot of things that the NAACP could be tackling right now, and I think that's where it needs to regain its focus.
Let me just add one thing. I mean, I think that we have to get beyond race. With great due respect, I think the problem for the NAACP and like organization is to translate the historical claim of blacks, which has come out of civil rights, into a universal progressive claim to be a part of the rebuilding of the Democratic Party and the rebuilding of a, you know, center-left kind of politics in the United States. We got to be talking about what about the Mexicans?
Glenn, is it realistic to assume? Let me just realistic to assume, but let me interject here. Is it realistic to assume that you can get away from race when the country doesn't?
Well, why can't the country get away from it if we're not getting away from it? It's kind of, I think, what you're saying, Professor.
It's a it's a transition. I'm saying coalitions have to be built. I'm saying people have to be looking down the line. We need to be moving from the historical civil rights orientation into something else. And the something else presumably will span racial bounds, and that the responsibility in the NAACP now is to manage this kind of transition.
You know what? One of the things I often tell my students is that the words civil rights are not synonymous with black people's rights. Civil rights applies to all of us. That's what the first 10 amendments to the Constitution were kind of trying to deal with. All of us supposedly have these rights. And if somehow the NAACP and other organizations can communicate that, I think that will help us to get down this road that you're talking about, Dr. Lowry.
Right, I don't think the NAACP, though, can be a catch-all for everyone. And also,
why not?
Because you're extending yourself too thin if you're going to do
what?
Everything for everybody.
But,
again,
but what are the things
they're
doing? Everybody needs good housing. Everybody needs good health. So what's the problem?
Certainly. I agree with that completely. But I just don't believe that you can encompass every single person. You have to have a focus. And that's what they lack.
The focus should be the issue, though, not the color of the skin of the person.
All right.
Okay.
We'll have to agree to disagree.
Hey, if nothing else, this may show how far African Americans have come in the fact that we're having this discussion and this deviation of thought here. Something interesting came out of one of the local papers in Milwaukee based on, obviously, the NAACP being there and the convention. One of the papers talked to local leadership, civil rights leaders within the city of Milwaukee. One of the interesting points that one old-school local leader suggested that is that we have seen a shift, quite frankly, in what African Americans and the community needs to look at by virtue of what's holding us back, quote unquote. His suggestion was, in the old days, it was a legalized system of segregation. But today, the African American population is being destroyed by its own youth. He called it an enemy from within. I'm curious, Larry, what you think when you hear of this. Quite frankly, this is talked about oft times behind closed doors, that we are now our own worst enemy.
Well, you know, we've been at this for a long time. I actually wrote a piece in the Washington Post 20 years ago, literally, with the title, Blacks Must Now Confront the Enemy Within. And I'm not saying that to pat myself on the back, just to say this has been going on for a long time. Bill Cosby is now going around doing what he's doing. I mean, yeah, it's true. We do have some serious problems. I don't much like this metaphor, the enemy within, because, of course, our children are not the enemy. I mean, that's obviously wrong. Moreover, whatever the nature of those problems, there still remain public, civic, and political issues, like what do police do when they have the capacity to use violent force on people? Like, what are the programs and the institutions that we have to take care of people who are destitute or who don't have opportunity? Like, why schools don't function, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And those are public questions. They don't have to do with enemies within. So you know, yeah, duly noted, there are some problems with African-American youth. But let's keep our thinking straight about what the political and public questions are here.
Well, let's Earship, historically, let me ask you this. Historically, and this is no different perhaps than what we saw in the past, but I'm curious your thought here. We have often seen local leaders like this gentleman in Milwaukee be more apt to say controversial statements or statements that some will say will get to the crux of the matter versus national leaders who may believe that that is too incendiary to say in public and perhaps too politically incorrect. Is that part of the problem, that we're not seeing our, quote, national leadership get up, stand up, and really be willing to look in the mirror?
I can say yes on that, but I also have to go back to what we talked about before. Who are the national leaders and who picks the national leaders and all of that? One thing about this particular issue that comes to mind is that some of the particularly local leaders who are familiar with what's going on in their communities are quick to jump on white people doing something against black people. But, and that's important, as Dr. Lauer just said, we have to focus on the public policy aspects of some of that. But at the same time, you don't hear them speaking, whether publicly or quietly, to the people who are doing something wrong. I think about the most recent Howard Beach incident. Three young black men were set upon by some white guys. The story then became that white guys were beating up black guys. The message that was lost was that the black guys, apparently, according to the reports, were there to steal a car. So, yes, you don't want the message to be that black people can't go into any neighborhood they want to be in, but you can at the same time not hold the black folks accountable for what they were doing wrong. So in that sense, I applaud this man in Milwaukee talking about the enemy within, whether or not we agree with the phrase. He is focusing on something that we know is true. There are people, young, sometimes not so young, who are doing wrong, and we don't hold them accountable.
All right. Let me get to something very quickly with about 3 minutes left. And it's something we spoke of yesterday on this roundtable. But subsequently, we saw the White House really have to put up and circle the wagons yesterday. Spokesperson Scott McClellan was stonewalled with questions about Karl Rove's alleged involvement in the leaking of the CIA operative. And the story obviously later became a part and parcel of two reporters facing jail time for not revealing their sources. We've dealt with that quite a bit. But Bob Meadows, I'm curious what your thought is of the fact that the White House for some time denied the fact, adamantly, quite frankly, that Karl Rove was the leak when asked. And now their suggestion is that he's done nothing wrong, and they're trying to obviously jump over these questions as quickly as they're coming.
Bush said he would fire whoever the leak was. Last time I checked, Karl Rove still has a job. Those two things are kind of a contradiction, I believe. Not that I'm surprised. Bush very well may not have known that Karl Rove was the leak. I'll give him that much. But once he found out, after he's been saying this for 2 years, that he would fire the leaker, he should fire the leaker.
But he needs Karl Rove as his political strategist.
True.
So now he's challenged to see which is more important. Maybe Karl Rove will lose his job at the White House, but still be his political strategist in whatever endeavors the GOP needs him.
Glenn Lowry, does the president have to do something if, in fact, we hear definitively from Karl Rove that, yes, I am the person who made this suggestion, and we should note that there's some hair splitting as to whether or not he said the name exactly, et cetera, et cetera.
Whether is but, means is and R means exactly. R.
So that being said, will this president have to do something? Will he have to hold, as Bob Meadows suggests, to his word? And we saw the president adamantly come out and say, you know, I hate leaks. This was wrong. When we find out who it is, they're gone.
Well, Ed, I have to tell you, it's a Washington story, and I'm up here in Boston, you know. I mean, seriously.
That's the point, Dr. Lowry. It really is a Washington story.
You know, I mean, we've seen this before. Obviously, it's a fire that they're going to have to put out at the White House. You know, I don't know all the facts, but,
Well, forget the facts. Forget that it's a Washington story. Forget that you're in Boston. Here's a
the answer is no. The answer to your question, in my opinion, is no. He does not have to fire Karl Rove because he is George W. Bush. He's the man in town. And if he doesn't fire him, people squeal for a week or two, and that'll be the end of that.
But you know what? I know you've covered this story before, but it still seems to me it's so convoluted that most people don't even get it. I think what people need to know from this whole business is that the First Amendment rights that all of us think we have are being trampled upon, and that two people, actually one person right now, is in jail for not having written a story about somebody she talked to who leaked information to somebody else.
Right.
And now we got this whole convoluted thing going on. But the whole point is, all of us who know what the First Amendment is supposed to guarantee should be worried that this White House in particular is circumventing the First Amendment.
All right. And that would be Judith Miller, the New York Times.
Judith Miller, the New York Times.
Right. And it wouldn't be for the first time they had done so.
Okay. Bob Meadows, E.R. Shipp, Glenn Lowry, we thank you very much for joining us for today's roundtable. Greatly appreciated.
Thank you.